Are we on to the next item on the agenda?
I think we're ready to.
Okay. You have two lovely Siegel Blue books, and John pointed out to me that the way to tell these apart is one of them has 147 pages, and one has 146 pages. I'm not kidding. So these are perfectly balanced, okay? This is balanced actuarial practice. The other way to tell them apart is one of them you should read, and the other one you shouldn't. Because
I hope I read.
Well, unless you are an auditor or accountant working for one of your employers. But what we have here, the last thing on the agenda, I believe, is the adoption of the GASB 68 valuation. So make sure you have that one in front of you and then put it aside, okay? And then on top of it, you should put the one that says actuarial valuation review as of December 31, 2015. That is our next agendized item. This is the what I mentioned of the three things that you get from your actuary, the three decisions that you have to make. This is the one you do every year. So here we have the actuarial valuation review, December 31, 2015. We have kind of a preferred practice. You notice that we do not have slides on this. We actually would like you to get used to and comfortable with and happy and eager to read through the actuarial report to see all the great information that's in here. So we will be presenting from the report itself. And we'll just leave C plus I up there just to keep you honest as we're going along. So this is like most reports. It has sort of a pyramid format. You know, section one is a very high-level summary. There's some text and a few tables. Section two gets into a little bit more of the evaluation results. Section three gets into some of the demographic information. And then section four is really mostly the basis of the valuation, a detailed description of the plan and of the actual assumptions and a couple other schedules. So what we're going to do is we're going to live in section one, which has Roman numerals. Page single I is really purpose and scope. This is pretty much boilerplate. Nothing, where we got the information and what we do with it. So, but section page double I at the top has a handy summary of your unfunded liability amortization policy. It's just written out there. It's what one that we saw on an earlier slide. And actually, John, maybe next year you'll see on the when we get to the significant issues here on page double I. Does anybody have page double I in their blue book? You'll see in the left margin there are reference pages. I have written in for mine up at the very top there where it talks about the unfunded liability amortization policy. I put in a reference of pages 70 to 81 because that's where the amortization bases are. And John, maybe we'll add that next year. So I'd like you to turn with me in section 3. And let's go to the end, page 81. Now I'm gonna hit you with a trick question here, and then we're gonna see if John can answer it. we have not rehearsed this part. So what you've got here, this is what I was describing. This is where you can basically read the history of your unfunded liability at least back to 2007. Because in 2007, you didn't have all these layers. What you had was an unfunded liability of $1,147,000,000. You see there at the middle column where it says initial amount, December 31, 2007. Okay? Now, you'll notice there are 7 years remaining there. And there's also 7 years for the next three layers. And then the next one jumps to 11. Now, you might think, did we fall asleep for 4 years? Did something not happen? What happened here was when we did the resetting of the amortization back in 2007, that was 8 years ago, there were, I think, 15 years remaining on your single unfunded layer back at that time. And so the board made a decision, while you're going to go to layered amortization going forward, you left that layer alone, and you left it on its 15-year schedule. 15 years back in 2007, of which there are now 7 years left. You had three other layers that had been created because of pension obligation bonds. You notice that these are credits. You see they have parentheses around them. These are reductions in unfunded liability because the employer issued a pension obligation bond, took the proceeds of that bond, and handed it to you, the system. Well, we don't want to treat that as a general gain loss, otherwise all the employers will get a credit for a payment that was only made by one of them. So these three employers had their own separate little amortization layer. It's an amortization credit, right? Not a charge. Well, those were not re-amortized. Those were left on the schedules they were on. So that's why you have those four sevens there. Then, the very next year, in 2008, we do the first actuarial valuation under the new policy. You have an actuarial loss of $131 million. You see it there? And by the way, we know what that was. That was the market downturn in 2008, but it wasn't all of it, right? It was one-fifth of it. So that's basically one-fifth of the market downturn in 2008. So that gets amortized over how many years? 18. How many years remain?
11.
Come on, it's right there.
11.
And how much of that 131.778 remains to be paid? 118.
18,000.
And how much is the current year payment? 13.3. So here, you can see everything here except what the initial amortization period. We have somewhere we actually put that in too. But for all of these new layers, the initial period would say 18. And then based on what year it is now and what year this one was created, you can back into how many years are left. So your total unfunded, now go down to the bottom where it says outstanding balance. We will see this number later, over and over and over again. Your new UAAL, as of this valuation, is $1,312,000,000. If someone says, where did that come from? Well, except for the part that's lumped together from 2007, we can actually tell you. Now, it's interesting to note, look at the 2007 layer, the very top one. Of that $1,147,000,000, you have, I'll put only in air quotes, only 837 left. And in 7 years, that's going to be paid off. And that layer is going to drop off. And so that charge of $138 million, that's going to stop about 8 years from now. That's the nature of layered amortization. You do get to actually pay off chunks of your liability. Now, this, again, is all where you can read down and see what has happened to this plan and the unfunded of this plan since 2007. I do like to, I'm picking out the gain-loss ones. We saw 2008 was 131.778, right? Then the next gain-loss is 280. That's pretty ugly. The next gain-loss is 285. Mm-hmm. They're getting worse. The next gain-loss is 194. Next gain loss is 245. You might say, man, what's wrong with your assumptions? You got five pretty chunky losses in a row. Is that because the assumptions were wrong, do you think? Why do we have five big losses in a row in a plan that had a big loss in 2008 and is using five-year asset smoothing? This is it. This is the thing about asset smoothing. Asset smoothing, it's like you manage market volatility twice. You first run it through its own five-year shock absorber, and the stuff that comes out of that gets into the unfunded. So when we talk about asset smoothing, is that there are market gains and losses that are deferred and are not yet recognized in the unfunded. We'll see that snapshot today. What this means is that back in the 2008 valuation, you had, if 280 is the part you recognize, that means four times that is what you didn't recognize. So you actually had deferred losses on the order of $1 billion. And you then recognize that deferred loss of $1 billion in four parts each of the next four valuations. That's why you have five actuarial losses in a row. That's basically climbing up the side of the mesa. That is the smoothing method, bringing into the unfunded one-fifth of a $1.2 billion loss in each of 5 years, once in the immediate year and the four next ones. So that's why you get this pattern when you have a huge loss like that. That's going to dominate what you read in here. And you can read all the other cool stuff. Every time there's an assumption change, some of these assumption changes have a footnote. Those were not the regular triennial every 3 year ones. I think John describes a couple.
A lot of them were.
A lot of them were.
But there were some that there was one or two that were out of cycle, as noted on page 82.
Yeah, the ones that have a footnote 2 are the ones that just came every 3 years. The other ones had to do with, we had a lot of discussion about how to deal with leave cash outs. And that include how we modified the assumptions that anticipate future leave cash outs. Some of those assumptions were not done as part of the triennial cycle, what were done out of cycle. So that's why normally these would be a fairly simple chart. You have a gain loss every year. And every 3 years, you have an assumption change. Well, you have that here, but you also got some other stuff, some of which had to do with the cash-out assumptions. You get a prepayment from First Five. They get their own layer in 2011. Sanitary made a prepayment. So you basically can see anything that involves an extraordinary change in the unfunded liability. Is everybody else as excited about this page as I am? I mean, it's just a wealth of information. We have folks say, you guys, you make this stuff so complicated. You have all these layers. Well, first of all, it's a spreadsheet, okay? It's not going to hurt you. But as far as the transparency, not only of where it came from, but when the unfunded is going to get paid off, I just think you can't really do much better. We had one system that had been using the single layer stuff declining, and we went in and we recommended they should go to layered amortization, and they liked it so much they asked us if they should sue their prior actuary for not telling them about layered amortization because it's that cool. So anyway, that's layered amortization. What? I said, no, don't sue that. Never sue your actuary. Just don't, you know. So, well, we've made it. So now go back to section one. Bye-bye. Any questions on the amortization schedule? No? Okay. Go back to section one, page II. Now we move into the significant issues in the valuation year. The first one, the big one, as you'll see, is that we adopted some new actuarial assumptions. We show here that the aggregate impact on the employer rate was to increase it by just over 2.5% of pay. And the aggregate increase on the average member rate is about 40 basis points, 0.4% of payroll. And we will look at where those numbers came from in some further detail. Page 88 is just the list of all the assumptions. That's in section 4. That's the do not try this at home section. But you're welcome to wade through the description of the assumptions. One thing that is a little bit handy in section 4, which we will not go through today, there's actually a plan summary in there. It is not a legal, summary plan description. What it is a description of what we are valuing in our computer. So if you are ever reading that plan summary in this report and you see something, you go, I don't think that's right, you should notify the fund office because it could be that we do not have the most up-to-date plan provisions. So we use that section of the report to communicate with your staff to make sure we're current on plan provisions. Another neat thing back there, have you ever tried to read the 1937 Act? It's tough. It's real tough. But what we have back there is for each of the formulas, we actually have the code section. If you want to go look it up in the 37 Act and see where that particular formula came from, we have those references back in Section 4. Okay. That's the plan summary. So, significant issues. The next bullet here, the one that says 17, now this is the one where this is probably the newest and the most discussed part of your recent action on your economic assumptions. Historically, a lot of public sector plans, most ones in California, when they're developing the expected return on assets, it is calculated net of expenses. In particular, it's calculated net of both investment expenses and administrative expenses. Okay, we made a recommendation to the board that they consider continuing to do the assumption net of investment expenses. No one is arguing that that should be done. There aren't many alternatives to that. But a lot of plans, especially outside the public sector, actually put a separate explicit loading for administrative expenses. And public sector plans are moving in that direction. So that was the recommendation made to the board. We recommended a particular way to do that. The version adopted by the board was a slight modification, but the same general intent. So that's what this describes. I'm going to have John go through the detail, but the summary here is that the estimated expenses, administrative expenses for the next year is 1.14% of payroll. So we're basically taking the normal cost and the unfunded liability payment, right? And we're adding to those a loading of 1.14%, and then that gets allocated between the employers and the members on the basis of a procedure that was specified by your board and adopted by your board. So if you turn in section 2 to page 17, John, why don't you, this will be the first time you've seen this, although you actually saw this in a letter, as we wrote you a letter describing how the administrative expense loading would be implemented. It looked just like this because that's where we got it. So so this is a review of what's in that letter, but you will see this every year in your actual.
Well, this might be a good time to take a very brief break.
It's a break. I was looking for a perfect time. Yeah.
Good moment. Sure. Okay, and then John's on when we get back.
Yeah, we'll go through the admin expense and then the rest of the bullets.
Okay. Aim at 5 minutes and hopefully not too much more than that.
Recording paused.
Okay, if we could get started. Monroe?
You have a present today.
So we're on page 17 of the report here. We're about back talking about the explicit administration expense load. This page has all the details of how we drive that load and so on. At the top of that page, so the administration expense load is set based on the actual administration expenses during 2015, which is about $8.1 million. And then we divide that by the actual payroll during 2015, which is about $710 million. And that results in 1.14% of payroll explicit administration expense load. So it's the actual administration expenses during 2015 divided by the total compensation during 2015. So that 1.14% expense load, we need to figure out then how to allocate it between the employers and the members. And what the board adopted was that we should allocate that based on employer and the member portion of the normal cost. So in the middle of this page 17, we show what the employer and the member normal costs are before the expense load. So employer, it's 16.63% of payroll. Member, it's 11.62% of payroll. And if you look at those as weightings, you'll see that the employer weighting is about 59% of the normal cost, and the member is about 41% of the normal cost. So member, employers are paying near 60% of normal cost, members are paying near 40% of normal cost. That's how the explicit administration load has been allocated in this report. Basically 60-40, 60% to the employer, 40% to the member. So the total load is 1.14%. So when we do the 60-40 weighting on that 1.14%, we get 67 basis points added to the employer and 47 to the member, as shown kind of in the middle of this page here. And then at the bottom of the page, we show how we take that 67 basis points to the employer and allocate it between the employer normal cost and the employer unfunded liability. Basically, we allocate 47 basis points to the employer normal cost to match how much is getting loaded to the member normal cost, and the remaining 20 basis points goes to the UAL rate, kind of at the bottom of the page there. So whenever you see like the rate tables that follow in the middle of this report or the member rate tables at the end of the report, there'll be a footnote there and talks about how much explicit administration expense load was added to the employer cost or the member cost. So that's how we derive those numbers.
Any questions?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
So this is an additional cost to both the employer and the employee outside of the normal cost, correct?
I would say that's correct.
Outside the normal cost and for the employer, outside the amortization payment as well.
Okay.
We had to add it to something, so we added it to both pieces, but it's on top of the cost that comes out of the big pie chart, you know, the little yellow slice down there. It's really on top of that.
So my understanding with GASB, that the intent was more of an accounting principle and not so much of an actual cost onto the employer and the employee, because if you're taking this out of the normal cost previously, because this was normally in the normal cost, right?
No.
Well,
it was before.
Well, it's tricky. This is the question of where it was before is there's not a short answer, and that's one of the reasons that I think that the board found this approach attractive, because under the old approach, the administrative expenses were being implicitly funded through a reduction in the discount rate, maybe, depending on rounding. Yeah. But in the derivation of the discount rate, you would back out a portion for administrative expenses, and whether that actually made it point for point into what the board adopted literally has to do with how things got rounded at the last step. But remember, if it's in the discount rate, then it's not only in the normal cost, it's in every actuarial number. It's in the unfunded liability. Mm-hmm. It's in the whole present value of future benefits, and therefore it's in the present value of future normal cost and in the actual accrued liability, which means it's in the unfunded liability. So it was in both.
Okay.
Right.
So then, if, for example, you know, PEPRA says that all PEPRA members have to pay 50% of the normal cost. Up to 50%. So then is this on top of that, the 0.47 for the employees?
Well, what we've done in terms of how this is incorporated into the results, you know, as John said, part of it is allocated to the normal cost, and the part that's allocated to the normal cost is the same for the employers and the members. So the way that we actually backed into this is you made as a decision as a board how the total 1.14 would get split between the members and the employers. That was your decision. Now, with PEPRA in mind, okay, and those two numbers, if you remember, are 0.67, right? You see it in the middle of page 17, the 0.67 and the 0.47, okay? And then we said, well, of the 0.67 for the employer, how much are we going to put in the normal cost, and how much are we going to put into the unfunded liability? So we actually were driven by the PEPRA constraint. And we said, well, before the administrative load, we're going to split the normal cost 50-50. We're now going to add 47 basis points to the member rate. The member only has a normal cost rate. So we're going to add the 47 basis points to the member's normal cost rate. How much of the 67 points that goes to the employer should go to the employer's normal cost? Well, PEPRA likes to have those two equal, so we added the same 47 points of the employer's total cost, the total 67, the same 47 got added to the employer's normal cost, which means that the 20 basis points that goes into the employer's unfunded liability rate, that's a balancing item. That basically is what's left over.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm up to be as candid as we can. You could say, well, then you're just forcing the numbers to come out even, so you can say that you're passing the PEPRA test. I'd say it's true.
Yeah. Okay. So just to be clear, so the employees are paying, so PEPRA employees are paying 50% of the normal cost.
Right.
So whether that, let's say that just for simple numbers, let's say that payroll is $100 for the, and so then the pension system that would cost $20. So just very simple numbers. Half of that would go to the employee out of their payroll, correct?
Would come from the employees, right?
Come from the employees, right. Excuse me. So $10 would come from the employees.
Mm-hmm.
So now this administrative cost would be another, would be cents in my example, correct?
Maybe a dollar,
okay.
Yeah.
So it's an additional cost on top of the employee.
On top of the
50%.
Oh, if we call the normal cost the benefit normal cost, it's an additional cost on top of 50% of the benefit normal cost, the normal cost that's driven by the valuation of the benefits. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I don't understand. I guess I'm having trouble understanding if PEPRA says that the employee is going to be paying 50% of the normal cost, and we take something out of it that was previously in the normal cost.
Stop right there. It was not all in the normal cost.
But it was.
It's part of it.
In fact, if you actually go back and look at, by the way, what this board adopted something slightly different than what we recommended on this. Because if you look at the current weighting of total contributions, okay, all of which are driven by the implicit expense calculation. Remember, when we take the expenses out of the discount rate, they affect the unfunded number and they affect the normal cost. Both, both. So what we originally recommended was we would have taken the 1.14 and weighted it by the total employer contribution compared to the total member contribution. In that case, the weighting toward the employer would have been much bigger because it includes the unfunded liability, which means that instead of this being split 67-47, it would have been split more like 80 and 30, thereabouts. So if you really want to try to follow what was being done before, because the unfunded liability is all on the employer was implicitly paying much more than half of the expenses. So now we get to Pepper, and you're right, Pepper says split the normal cost 50-50, but nobody says that administrative expenses are all normal cost. And in fact, under your prior practice, they were more unfunded liability than they were normal cost. Mm-hmm. So we came in with a recommendation that tried to mirror that result, and you as a board took one that went a little bit closer to a 50-50 sharing. You'll notice that this weighting of normal cost, using the weightings of the normal cost, maybe that can be a little bit misleading. The fact that you as a board decided to use normal cost as the basis for your weighting doesn't mean that administrative expenses are inherently only a normal cost. Mm-hmm. That was a policy decision you made. It's worth noting here, you'll see that this is not a 50-50 split, right? 67-47. Mm-hmm. Well, 30 years from now, right, when all the legacy tier folks are gone from the active membership, and all that's left is Pepper tiers, those are going to be equal. Because then the only normal cost in the room will be the Pepper normal cost. Those are split 50-50, and therefore the administrative expenses will be split 50-50. The only reason that these are not 50-50 today is because in practice, under the legacy tiers, the split of the normal cost is not 50-50. It's actually a little bit more to the employers, a little bit less to the members. Mm-hmm. And when you blend that non-50-50 with the small numbers but growing Pepper members, which are 50-50, that's where you get 58.8 and 41.1.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you could, a Pepper member could make the argument that if you followed your recommendation under the weighted method, that would be more accurate of being normal cost for the administrative portion.
They would say it would be less accurate toward the normal cost because it includes the unfunded, but it would be a more accurate reflection of prior practice. But prior practice was not driven by normal cost; it was driven by total cost. That's the key. If the Pepper member says I want to do it based more on normal cost, that's going to move more on the 50. That's actually what you adopted as a board. You adopted an allocation based on the current normal cost split, which is a hybrid of legacy and PEPRA. Whereas that is more toward the members than an approach that would have reflected the prior practice. The key I keep going back to, the prior practice was not normal cost driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that a PEPRA member could argue if you followed your recommendation, it would be more fair to the PEPRA employee for their portion of administrative expense versus the 67-47 split.
Well, it depends what you mean by fair. If a Pepper member really believes that 50-50 is the right answer, then they would say we should be using 50-50 here, which would not be to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. But
I guess it's the legacy member that could argue that they would have been better off if we had done things the old way.
But Paul, your recommendation was that because the employer has much more due every year in terms of the unfunded liability,
yep,
all those other things, all the prior employees to administer, you can make that argument
exactly
that the current Pepper member who's been on maybe 1 year has less of a weight for administrative expenses than the employer should have for all their previous employees.
Sure.
That's my point.
Yeah, and that would be there's a very loose tie between theory and practice here, mm-hmm, because it's very hard to come up with an exact theoretical measure of what the old approach did because it's so implicit. Mm-hmm. But that was our rationale behind weighting the split based on total contribution rather than just normal cost, the theory being, and a little bit of a hand wave theory, that, well, there's the cost of administration of the inactive members who are all in the unfunded liability, and maybe that should be the employers. Although someone could say, wait a second, if we're all helping to run the plan here, then why shouldn't the active members help pay for the administration of the retiree benefits? Who says that that's only on the employer? So I don't think there are any, there's no right or wrong answers here. You can make cases for either.
Yeah.
And we recommended one split, which was more reflective of past practice. You adopt an approach that I think is more consistent with the emerging thought of split the normal cost 50-50, and administration maybe feels more like a normal cost. I'm putting words in the board member's mouth now, and that is why they use the normal cost as the basis for the allocation. We had a hand on this side here.
Yeah, just without rehashing all of the intricate arguments we got into in a two-hour meeting over this topic in the past when we made the decision, I think it was it was just generally a concept of what you just got to at the end. That's why I put my hand down, which was that concept of sharing the plan. You know, does everyone share in the administrative cost of the retirees and so forth? And the other concept there was that the unfunded liability was a cost from the past. It was a cost incurred in the past, and it's just something that we're paying off because of our amortization, which you've very carefully explained earlier. And so should the current administrative expense be allocated based on that unfunded liability piece, which was really a past cost? And should we use that past cost as a part of that allocation of the current cost?
Yep. Now, this, again, this is such a, I mean, I get all touchy-feely at this point. This is exactly how boards are supposed to address these kinds of issues. This is how, this is why it's important that the board own these decisions. And we get nervous when you think the actuary just brings in their black box and you just do what you're told. But we don't like that model. And so this is a case of you as a board with a very clear understanding of exactly what we just reviewed here, made your own very carefully justified, very carefully reasoned decision on this, and focusing exactly on just the policy questions. Who pays for past costs? Does the fact that the employer pays for past costs mean they should pay for more administration? Well, do we go to just a 50-50 split? We could have done that too, you know. Well, but you know, the split for current service right now is different between the legacy and the PEPR tiers. Well, do we have a number that would capture both of those? We do, and it's right here. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get to this number.
Definitely.
And it's very carefully reasoned number.
Definitely. And the reason I brought it up is because a lot of my constituents are actually saying, hey, why is this additional administrative cost in? And they weren't present at the meeting. There's a larger attendance here today, and it came out in the report saying, hey, their costs are actually going to be going up. So that's why I brought it up.
Fair enough. And the hardest part, when we were making this presentation, we kept asking, well, show us what the costs were under the old system. Well, we can't do that. What do you mean you can't do that? I mean, it is, you know, we talk about transparent. The opposite of transparent is opaque. And you know, paying for administrative expenses through an adjustment in the unrounded discount rate, I don't know what the mathematical definition of opacity is, but it's pretty opaque. It's very hard to really get in there and figure out who's paying what. And the reason nobody ever cared is because it was so buried in the calculations you couldn't see it.
Well, I'm not sure that this was ever really ever brought, this topic was
I assure
never
you
brought
it wasn't.
To yeah. us yeah. because it was sort of realized as a result of the new GASB regulations requiring us to split this out.
It was a recommendation, wasn't it, by GASB?
It was. Well, it was for GASB, it was a requirement. but we were very clear, this is not required by GASB. We will admit that in our practice, bringing up this topic was prompted by GASB, but, you know, you get ideas from all kinds of places. But we'd always start off by saying, you know, ask your members if they knew that in the past they were in some implicit way paying for administrative expenses. They go, what do you mean? I don't know. I'm just... You know, it's not in here, you know. So we do think that there's some advantage just to the transparency, but there is a birthing pain making the transition and getting to that point. Because now a cost that used to be hard to see, I picked those words very carefully, hard to see, is now right on the page. And that's always going to be a tough transition to make. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.
Sure. Okay. And by the way, that was, you know, this is, we call this a relatively uneventful evaluation. We got the experience study, but this was the hot topic for this evaluation. That's why we're here in October instead of July, too. So it's okay. So with that, we will go back to the front of the report. John, anything else?
Nope.
Well, actually, I had a question on that. When do these numbers get revised? I was still on page 17. This is based upon the current one-year expenses. So the 1.14, the total, is that going to get redone each year?
Yeah, every single year we'll look at the actual administration expenses, the actual payroll, and the 1.14 will change based on that.
And then the weighting will also change.
Weighting, right? Could also change as the employer and normal and member normal costs shift over time. As Paul mentioned, a long, long time from now, they'll be 50-50. But as those numbers slowly move over time, the allocation of the administration expense between the employer and member will shift too.
Right. Okay. Okay. Section one. So that was, well, we're almost done with page double I. No, but that's, we put all the hot stuff up front. I mean, come on. Okay, at the bottom of double I, now for the first time we get to, these are the bullets you will see in every single Siegel actuarial report. Okay, we start with the new stuff, right? The assumptions were new, the administrative expenses were new. But next year, unless we do something else new, right, the first bullet will be the one that's at the bottom of page double I. We start by looking at the funded status of plan, both as a ratio and in dollars. We start with a ratio because that's what everybody likes to talk about. I am a funded ratio agnostic myself. I like to tell at the long pension 101s, you can go through the entire evaluation, collect the data, run the evaluation, get the assumptions, check the numbers, publish the report, bring it in here, talk about it, and you adopt the rates, send the rates to the employer, employer adopts the rates. Do the whole thing and never once calculate the funded ratio. It is a useless number in terms of actually running the plan. The number that we use is the dollar amount of the unfunded. Now that's a very important number. That's the number that we amortize over 18 years in layers, divided by payroll to come up with an important part of the employer's contribution. But everybody likes to talk about funded ratios, so we put them here. But we don't actually use this number in the valuation. Well, when people say, well, you got two funded ratios here, one on market value, and one on the smooth value. We talk about the smooth one first. You know, if I'm in Starbucks and somebody comes up and says, oh, you're a pension trustee, what's your funded ratio? Which number do you tell them? Do you tell them the funded ratio on a smooth basis or on a market value basis? Yes. And the answer is yes. Got to give them both. We learned this back in 2009, because in 2009, these numbers were 20 basis points apart. Sorry, 20 percentage points apart. 20 percentage points apart. Huge spreads. We'll look here in a little bit about how these numbers kind of dance with each other. But you really, you know, the unfunded liability on a smooth basis determines this year's contribution rates. The unfunded liability on a market value basis tells you where you're heading if the market going forward earns exactly 7%. So one is sort of the current snapshot in terms of this year's cost. That's the smooth basis. That's the one that we publish the most. But the market one tells you whether it's going to tend to go up or down over the next 4 years. And we will show you exactly how that works when we talk about smoothing. So in this case, is a classic case where the funded ratio actually went up on a smooth basis from 81.7 to 84.5. Well, that's a good year, right? But then on a market value basis, it went down from 86.1 down to 82.6. Now, when you're if you're an actuary grad school, right, if you've already been to all the courses, you know what that tells me? That tells me we must have had a bad year on market returns, but the last couple years must have been good years. Because on our smooth basis, we've got the good years still offsetting not the recent loss, one-fifth of the recent loss, whereas the market value, all it sees is the new loss. So this is pretty typical. If you've had a market that goes up and then there's a little downtick, that's going to mean that your smooth value is still living on the past gains, whereas the market value recognized all the gains last year. Remember the headache on Monday? It recognized all the gains on Monday, and now all it sees is that we had a downturn in the last 12 months. So that's why those numbers move in those directions. Let's take a look at some pictures. If you go to page 35, well, 35 is actually just for the unfun, a little bit of the history. 35 is in section 2, John, is that right?
Yep, 35, section 2.
Do we have a UAL graph in here? There it is, yeah, okay. So if you look on page 35, you see the unfunded as a percentage of, you can see the middle column that says unfunded or overfunded. Someday we will have overfunding. It's going to happen someday. So here you see the progression of the unfunded. You'll notice that it was bigger in 2012, and it has come down, right, in dollars. The funded ratio has actually moved up past 80%, but that's on a smooth basis. Now, back up one page. Back up to page 34. We're going to see a couple different pictures that show us smooth numbers compared to market numbers. We're going to look at, eventually, rates of return and the unfunded liability. But here's the funded ratios. So you can see what happened. Look at the gray boxes, okay? That's the funded ratio on a market value basis. And at the end of 2008, my head still hurts when I think about this. It was between 60 and 65%. And the smooth value on an actuarial basis was still up around 88%, all right? That's when you're at Starbucks and you have to tell them both numbers. Because if you tell them, hey, we're 88% funded, that's really not telling the whole story. But if you say that you're 65% funded, you know, that's a short-term snapshot of a long-term phenomenon. And then look what happens. What I love about these, you know, the gray really rides the market value. I'm sorry, the gray squares that some people don't see colors. So the gray squares ride the market value roller coaster. It recovered through 2010, dipped down a little bit 2011, pulled back up in 12, 13, 14, 13, 14 looking pretty good, and then it actually dips down a little bit in 2015 because of a market value loss. Look at the blue line. The blue line follows, sorry, the blue diamonds follows the contours of the market value, but it's, I don't know, smoother. So that's exactly what asset smoothing is supposed to do. I'm a big proponent of asset smoothing. The economists don't like it. They say you're hiding the true cost of the plan. I'm not making this up. We are hiding nothing. We are managing short-term volatility in about as transparent a way as we can come up with. So we watch that spread between the two. We talk about it all the time. I think if you look, you notice in 2011, we'll see this again in another graph. You can see it easier here. In 2011, the smooth value was still higher than the market value. That means we are deferring losses. It means we're calculating the cost of the plan based on more money than we really had. Now, this is where I got to make sure the press doesn't pull these into pull quotes out of context, you know, because this is the air and the ice cream. It's whatever image you don't like of living on the market roller coaster. But it goes the other way. When the market is doing well, like it was in 2012, 13, and 14, now the market value is higher. The smooth value is lower. We are deferring gains. It's like rainy day money instead of air in the ice cream, right? And we have deferred gains that can offset future losses. I remember distinctly in 2012, well, it was when we presented the report, which would have been in 2013, we said, look, for the first time since the big market downturn, the smooth value is actually below the market value. We have gone from deferring losses, those big losses in 8, 9, 10, and 11, we've gone to deferring gains. And I think we had cake, actually, to celebrate. So that was a good day. Well, I'm a little bit chagrined to say it's now gone the other way. Okay, so after 1, 2, 3 years, right, of smoothing, of deferring gains, rainy day money, now we are actually deferring a little bit of losses, which is the air and the ice cream concept. But remember, it's smoothing. It's supposed to go both sides. But we did spend 3 years in the sort of the deferring gains situation. Now, as we'll see later, we're actually deferring losses. That's what you can see, and this is why in Starbucks you want to talk about both numbers. One of them gives you a snapshot. One of them gives you a direction that includes your recent five-year history. But that crossover is actually kind of a significant thing if you love asset smoothing, as you all should. So. Ma'am.
I want to go back to page 36 on the volatility ratios.
Really?
You mentioned it, and then you, or we turned to it quickly, and then went the other way. I think maybe it was 35. So, were you going to talk about this, or
we will? It's not in the base package. But if you bought the premium channels, yeah, we can.
So, just quick, really, my question is quick.
I will talk about it. Yeah.
Just want to point out that I think your last line says here that. And in particular, I'm talking about the liability volatility ratio, is about 11.3. I'm in the last paragraph on that page. It's 22% higher than AVR, therefore we'd expect that contribution volatility will increase over the long term. The 11.3, if you look at the trend in the chart, the far right column, we're for this year now, this is 2015, and we have to keep in mind that we're talking about, you know, the year ended 10 months ago.
Yes.
Almost 10 months ago. So we're at 11.3, which is better than the 11.5 that we were last year, and we've kind of been hovering in the 11 range there for 5 years. Where is this? First of all, I want you to just give us a quick explanation of what that means and why it means that contribution volatility will increase over the long term. But also would like to know where we are in comparison to other plans on that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, about the volatility ratio, one of the things that the entire actuarial profession is moving toward is more conversations about risk. Okay. I talk about before we were doing public practice here, at least me and John, back when the new benefit tiers were being adopted. This is back around the turn of the century, SB 400, AB 1937. You know, there were a lot of studies about how this will change the expected cost of the plan. But what you didn't get was a lot of talk about how a new benefit formula will change not the expected cost, but the variability of cost around that expected cost. That is the uncertainty in the cost or the risk in the cost. So we're trying to come up with measures that convey not just how much you have to pay this year, but what can you expect going forward in terms of how much volatility there will be in future costs. Well, it's not an easy concept to convey or to quantify. You can do a stochastic study and talk about percentiles, and then people fall asleep, and then they realize that the percentiles are all made up on assumptions anyway. So this particular measure, these volatility ratios, are a way of trying to capture how the contribution rate as a percentage of pay is going to vary based on the structure and the demographics of the plan. Generally speaking, I mean, they're fairly simple numbers. You take the assets and divide them by payroll. And you take the accrued liability, not the unfunded liability, the accrued liability, right? The whole value of past service divided by payroll. Okay? Well, one thing to notice here is there's a big difference between general and safety. And let's use the liability ratio just as an example. Okay, you'll see that the liability ratio for general is 8.4. I'm going to round that to 10. Just for the conversation here. Let's pretend it's 10. The safety liability ratio is 23. I'm going to round it to 20. Just call it 20. Okay. What does that mean? So for the general members, the liability is 10 times payroll. For the safety members, the liability is 20 times payroll. And not to round out a contribution. And let's suppose we come in and we recommend an assumption change. Longer mortality table and lower discount rate, okay? And you adopt it. And that assumption change increases the liabilities by 10%. Okay? Increases the liability by 10%. Okay, well, for the general members, the liability ratio is 10. So liability is 10 times payroll. So if I take 10% of the liability, that's 1 times payroll. Right? I'm doing math with my fingers, but if this is 10 times as big as this, and I take 1/10 of this, well, then that 1/10 will equal this. So for the general members, if you have an assumption change that changes the liabilities by 10%, that basically increases the liabilities by a full year's worth of payroll. Now, the employer doesn't have to write a check for that this year. We're going to amortize it over 18 years. But eventually, that assumption change is going to cost them an amount equal to a full year of payroll. That's a liability ratio of 10. Let's do the same calculation for the general members.
Safety.
For safety members, yeah. For safety members, the liability ratio is 20. All right? So liability is 20 times payroll. If I take 1/10 of something that's 20 times payroll, that's going to be 2. 1/10 of 20 is 2. So the assumption change, the very same assumption change, which had the same percentage impact on the liability, instead of being equal to 1 year of payroll, it's equal to 2 years of payroll. Because for the same 10% change, take 10% of something that's 20 times payroll, that's going to be equal to double the payroll. So the same assumption change, when you look at the effect on the employer contribution rates, it's going to look twice as big as a percentage of pay for the safety members than it does for the general members. That is all the information, and the only information that we're trying to convey here, that anything that happens in the future to the liabilities, it's going to be more than twice as big. In fact, it's almost three times, right? 8.4. If it was 8, 8 times 3 is 24. It's going to be almost three times the impact as a percentage of safety payroll compared to the impact as a percentage of general payroll. That's what this tells you. Now, we haven't got to your question because you haven't mentioned the asset one yet, okay? So that's it so far. So we're trying to say, people always notice, why do safety rates always get hit harder? Whenever you guys change an assumption, why does safety get hit harder? It's because the relationship of liabilities to assets is bigger. Now, I'm not here to argue for or against any particular benefit formula, but one of the things that was not conveyed back when we were talking about going from 2 at 50 to 3 at 50, I know that those aren't exactly in proportion, but more or less, that's a 50% increase in benefits. It's actually less than that. It's actually less than that, but more or less. Well, that means that your liability ratio went up by half. So the higher benefits that were adopted in SB 400 and AB 1937 led to higher liability to payroll ratios, which means that in the future, every time you change an assumption, it has a bigger impact because of the higher level of benefits. That was not conveyed by the actual profession back when these were discussed, and that's on us.
I just want to clarify, so the impacts we're talking about, the huge impacts, are really on only the employer side because it's the unfunded liability that we're talking about, or does that affect the normal cost?
It is primarily on the employer. There is also, if you looked at the present value of future normal costs, which would be another ratio, right? Kind of like the accrued liability ratio, but it's the future piece. It also is going to be higher for safety, and that would affect the member rates. John, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you would see an effect also, the same kind of leveraging effect for the future normal costs. But again, the employer always gets hit harder because it's dealing both with normal costs and also with unfunded liability. Now, as to the asset, a lot of actuaries like to talk more about the asset volatility ratio because we think more of volatility in terms of what the market does year to year. I like using the assumption change example better because, one thing, it's more stable and it doesn't go away. It's more intrinsic to the plan design. The only thing that last comment is saying is that right now, because the assets are less than the liabilities, right, roughly 80%, that means that this ratio, if you had a volatility ratio, a liability ratio of 10, then your asset volatility ratio is going to be 8 because the assets are 80%. So you take 80% divided by payroll, and you get 8. Now, that, you can use the same example. If we have a 10% drop in asset value, okay, that's going to translate into 80% of 1 year of payroll for the general members and something like 20%, did I say 80? Make sure I get that right. 80% and then more like 160%, you know, that is more than a full year of payroll, less than two, I'd call it 160% of payroll for the general members. That last comment about one trending to the other, well, you think about it, eventually, right, the assets are supposed to catch up with the liabilities.
When the assets get to where they equal the liabilities, well, then your liability ratio and your asset ratio will be equal because it's the same number. So what we're really saying is that as the assets eventually grow to be equal to the liabilities, the asset volatility ratio will grow until it equals the liability volatility ratio. So if the liability volatility ratio is higher, that just means that you have an unfunded liability. I left a couple steps out there. You have an unfunded liability, and as you pay off, the employer pays off the unfunded liability, those numbers will pull together. That's all that's about there.
So where do we stand in terms of other 37 Act systems there? Are we?
I think these are pretty typical for 37 Act systems. Do you have a sense of it?
Well, what I could add is that these are the highest safety volatility ratios that I have ever seen. I will add that. So those are higher than other systems from what I've seen.
Okay. Now you might. I always want to say. So why do you want to know? I mean, to some extent, you know. To some extent.
Well, because I think you made some comments earlier about the unfunded amount doesn't matter, but it's less important than some people make it out.
Oh no, I said the ratio doesn't matter. The unfunded rate, the funded percentage, yeah. But listen, the funded ratio, I am overly dismissive perhaps the funded ratio. The funded ratio is good for one thing mainly, and that is to compare you to yourself over time. It is certainly true that moving the unfunded toward 100% will have the effect of reducing the burden on the employer, which will free up taxpayer resources for other things. So that's a good thing, as a sense of direction.
And reduce the overall volatilities that we're talking about as well, right, in terms of what an impact of an event would have on rates.
No, it really doesn't. No, here's a great irony for you. L.A. City has three plans. I'm focused on the two that everybody knows about, LACERS, general members, right, and fire police, they call it pensions. Jack Webb's pension plan, for the safety members. Okay, in 2007, the fire police plan, City of Los Angeles, was 100% funded, and the LACERS plan was about 80% funded. Okay, 2008, 2009, balance portfolio goes down 22%. Which plan got hurt more?
100%.
The better funded plan. A better funded plan is more volatile, not less volatile. That's just, no good deed goes unpunished, right? I mean, but the truth is, the better funded you are, the more volatility you're going to get because your assets are bigger as a percentage of payroll. Or as a multiple of payroll.
Do those two systems, though, have equal percentage of payroll contribution?
Oh, no, one was safety and one was general, so you know the answer to that. Safety benefits are higher than general benefits. Is that news?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I got it. Yeah. Give me something, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But John makes a good point. We work in California. We talk to folks around the state and around the country, and liability volatility ratio over 20. I mean, there are actuaries that never come to California who go, what? These are a very high volatility systems. They just are, and it's really because of plan design. Yeah. And you can't fund your way out of volatility. I guess that's really what we're saying here. You still want to do it. Intergenerational equity, all the other things, freeing up resources, taxpayer resources, but a better funded plan is going to do better when the market's up. It's going to do worse when the market goes down. And the LA example is just, you can't pass it up. Two plans that they used to be in the same building. And very different reactions to the market downturn. And the better funded plan got hurt more.
Got hurt in terms of their rates?
In terms of the increase in rates. Yeah, in terms of the increase in rates due to the market downturn.
Over a period of time?
Yeah, 5 years smoothing. I think actually they went to 7 years smoothing. But yeah, same idea. Yeah. Okay. Remember, I told you we were going to be doing actuarial one in the context of the.
You're proving it.
Okay. Next. So we are now on page triple I. Oh no, we're not. No, we're not. Sorry. We had looked at the history of the unfunded. I'm now going to go to, in a regular presentation of this, where we only had two bullets to start with, I would really spend all my time on two pages. We're going to get to the first of those pages. In page 69, which is in section 3. And as far as really decision use, you know, basically tangible information for you as trustees, in terms of what happened from last year to this year, there are two pages in here that have most of that. This is one, and we'll look at the next one in a second. We're now going to look and see what happened to your unfunded liability from last year to this year. 1 year of experience of this retirement system. So we start off last year, the unfunded liability, this is, would have been as December 31, 2014. As the trustee mentioned, you know, we're a year after the valuation date, right? We're today is December 31, 2015. So now we're a year before that. December 31, 2014, you had an unfunded liability of $1,470,000. We accrue the total normal cost. That's the total. That's the little wedge on the pie chart. That's employer and employee normal cost. We deduct expected contributions from the members and the employers. We adjust everything for interest. Last year's liability accrues a year of interest. And by the way, it doesn't accrue interest. What happens is everybody gets a year older, so they're a year closer to retirement, so we discount them one less year. It's not that you're like charging interest on a bond, but it behaves mathematically like you add a year of interest. It's actually one less year of discount. So everything gets closer to retirement by a year. That increases things by about $100 million. So the expected unfunded is $1,409,000. Now, that assumes that the contribution rates from the last valuation went into effect on the day of the valuation, as of December 31, 2014. They don't really. There's an 18-month lag. So we're going to see there's going to be a difference between the actual contributions and the expected contributions. So we'll get to that. So now, $1,409,000, if you had paid exactly the actual valuation rate starting December 31, 2014, and if all the assumptions came true, that would be your unfunded this year. We wouldn't have to collect any new data, right? We could just be real easy valuation, but it's not that way. So we now look at what actually happened. First of all, the investment return. Remember, we didn't look at the returns on a smooth basis, but the return on a smooth basis was actually more than 7.25%. You actually had a gain on a smooth basis. We'll see that in a second. We're a little out of order here. So the investment return, you had a gain of $100 million. You had additional contributions from the sanitary district, $2 million, throw that in there. You actually had contributions greater than expected because you had... It was a decrease in the rates, and so since the lower rates didn't go into effect till 18 months later, you continue to collect the higher rates from the 13 valuation, collect those for a year. That actually went down $46 million. We were used to seeing that going the other way. After 2008, when the rates went up and up and up and up, you always had a contribution loss because the higher rates didn't go into effect until a year later, and we said, you know, it's going to go the other way someday. Well, this is someday. So you actually were paying the out-of-date higher rates for a year. That produced a contribution gain, $46 million. Now we get to where the actuary's sunny reputation, anything that you like, we don't like, anything you like, we don't like, anything that you don't like, we like. Well, the retirees do not like getting low COLAs, right? But if that COLA for a 3% tier, if it's less than 3%, that's an actuarial gain. Because we built into our liabilities a 3% increase that was not paid. That alone saved the plan's liability $29 million.
What was it?
Then we looked 2.5? At some, I jumped down to E. Okay. Now salaries are interesting. We had lower than expected individual salary increases, but not much. They were fairly close to the assumption, but that picked up a gain there again. You know, people don't like not getting raises, but it helps the valuation, about $10 million. Then we actually had a mortality gain. We had people dying ahead of schedule, as we say, at $19 million. Then we got another item of about $7 million.
You really want to include that, people dying earlier?
Well, oh, remember now, listen. Now, you know, notice, I'm going to turn that into a serious question. We did not change the assumption. We're not assuming it's going to continue. We're assuming it was just, you know, a bad bowl of soup somewhere, you know, at the end of dinner, right? So this is not the same, but that is a key point. This is not the same as changing the assumption. This is just saying that in a one-year period, we actually had a higher-than-expected mortality. Sorry, Jim.
Right.
And then we have this little thing called assumption changes. Well, if it wasn't for that, we actually would have had a net, is it still a net gain? Let's see, 197. I think we would have had a small net loss. Did I get the math right, John?
Yeah, I think.
It would have been about maybe an $18 million net loss. But as it was, we have an $18 billion net loss of all those pieces.
It would have been a net gain. $18 million.
Oh, because the 97 is a gain. I said, my mistake. I apologize. So we would have had a net gain. As it is, we still have a net gain, but it's not as big as it would have been. So if you add up everything except for the 115, that actually is about 213. I finally just got the signs right. If you add up the 100 and and all these other gains, 100 gain, 45 gain, 28 gain, 18 gain, that's about 213 million. You would have had a reduction in your unfunded liability below the new expected level of over $200 million. Well, of that $200 million reduction in your unfunded, about 113 of it instead, in effect, went to more conservative actuarial assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this would have been a banner year for gains through a whole combination of events. Deferred gains from the last couple years. Contributions greater than expected, COLAs and salaries, all these things would have advanced your funding, but then we remeasured the liabilities using more conservative assumptions that increased the liability by $113 million. I always like to say it didn't increase the assets. Funny about assumption changes, they just don't change the assets. So your liability goes up by $113 million, the assets are asleep, so your unfunded liability goes up by the same $113 million. Yeah, wake up those assets. Where's Tim again? So that's how we get to $1,311,000,000. Now again, this is a kind of a, let's have cake kind of a year. Your unfunded liability went from $1,470,000,000 down to $1,311,000,000 in a year when you strengthened, went to more conservative assumptions. No, doesn't get any better than that, right? Okay. Any questions on this? I want to get to contributions and assets moving, then we will stop. The next on triple I, the first full bullet, we've been talking about liabilities. Now we're going to talk about contributions. We focus mainly on the employer rate in this bullet. Now, we always talk about the aggregate rate. The aggregate rate is, I always like to say, it's a contribution rate that is not actually paid for any individual member in the plan. Okay? There is no member in the plan whose contribution rate for the employer is 29.23.
If 30.
39.23. Well, there also isn't one for 29. That's okay. 39.23. Okay. But if flip forward two pages to Roman 5, little v, this is why your report is 150 pages long, because you have a lot of cost groups. This shows here for each of the cost groups, for the six safety cost groups, the six general cost groups, what the employer rate did, rate by rate by rate, and then we average them all together, weighted by payroll at the bottom. So we do our reconciliation based on the 39.23, which is smack dab in the middle of page Roman 5.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's all the other rates that do all the calculation, and that's why we have a very thick book here, because all of those rates are presented in detail in this report. So why did the aggregate rate go down from 40.06 down to 29.23? 30. I keep doing that. I'm really trying to help here. 39.23. Well, we have a page on that. That reconciliation is on page 33, and it's in section 2. Okay, all together. 32. I'm having trouble with my tens place. So on page 32, this is going to look a little bit like the page we just looked at, where we did the reconciliation of the unfunded liability, because anything that affects the unfunded liability is also going to affect the employer contribution rate. But now instead of doing it in dollars of unfunded, we do it as a percentage of payroll. So these will be familiar. The 40.06 first Oh, by the way, if all the assumptions came true, in theory, that number would not change. The 40.06 is designed to be a level cost as a percentage of payroll. Remember, we amortize as a percentage of payroll. So if all the assumptions come true, the 40.06 will not change. That's the expected rate, if you will. Okay, so we pick up a full basis, full percentage point because of the investment loss. That's after smoothing. Here's the contribution from sanitary district. This 0.02 is over the whole plan. I think it has a larger effect than that if you look just at sanitary district. Here's the difference between the actual and expected contributions. That was the $49 million or so that we saw. That's turned into a percentage of pay. Lower than expected salary increases. Okay, now, this next one, the 72 basis points. This is the only one that did not appear on the earlier page about the unfunded. Why is that? What this is saying is if you take, if your payroll goes up faster than you expected, okay, if it actually goes by more than 3.25%, okay, so you take your unfunded payment and you divide it by a payroll that's bigger than you thought it was going to be, then as a percentage of that payroll, the rate's going to go down. In my mortgage example, remember you structured your mortgage, so it would go up at 4% a year. If 1 year you get a 10% raise, right, then your mortgage is now going to be smaller than you as a percentage because you thought you were going to divide it by a number that was 4% bigger than last year's pay, and you're actually dividing by a number that's 10% bigger than last year's pay. I won't try to repeat that sentence. So the idea is because pay went up faster than assumed, the unfunded payment as a percentage of payroll looks smaller. And that's a significant effect. That's 72 basis points. Now, if you're really listening, you could say, now, just a second, Paul, I thought you said earlier that, see right above there, lower than expected individual salary increases. I thought you said we had a gain because salaries went up less than assumed. But then the very next line, it says that you're amortizing over a greater than expected payroll. How can salaries go up less than assumed, but when you're done, the total payroll is bigger than you thought it would be?
New hires.
There's only one way, and that is?
New hires.
New hires. So I'm not going to flip to the page, but there's a page in here that looks at the member demographics, and it shows that there was an increase in the active member headcount. So you have this somewhat anomalous result. Individually, you have salaries going less than assumed, which is a gain, but in the aggregate, you have salaries going greater than assumed, which isn't really a gain, but it makes the unfunded look smaller as a percentage of payroll. It's not smaller in dollars. It's just smaller because it's being spread over a bigger payroll, because an increase in headcount. Now, this is also, you know, sort of, are we in a recovery or not, right? Wages are not increasing at assumed levels, but we are starting to see some recovery on the headcounts. So that's how those two fit together. The others here are the same as what we saw before, lower than expected COLAs. Oh, now this is a new one, the change in member demographics on normal cost. Well, maybe it shouldn't surprise you that was not on the unfunded liability page, right? Because it's normal cost. This is really members shifting out of the legacy tiers into the PEPR tiers. We're going to look at a page where you can see those normal costs one above the other. Over a generation, as we transition from legacy normal cost tiers to PEPR normal cost tiers, you're going to see a trend downward in the aggregate normal cost. That's 57 basis points. So it is happening. And that's not a surprise. After all, if you have a lot of new hires, right, the new hires are all coming in, right, under the new tiers, that's going to shift the overall weighting into the new tiers, which means pension reform is doing its generational transition to a lower cost structure. We have the mortality gain. We already talked about that. There's another. And here's the actual assumptions. Okay, if you take the change in the unfunded liability, what was that, John? Was $113 million. Take the $113 million, amortize that over 18 years, plus the effect of the assumption change on normal costs, because it also increased normal costs, add those together, you get 67 basis points. You get 189 basis points. And then here is, for the first time, this explicit employer expense load. We already saw the 67 points, right? Remember, 67 and 47, right? 67, 47. This is the employer's piece. And again, I know it looks like this cost came out of nowhere. In fact, it used to be billed into the discount rate. Now it's an explicit loading. Okay? Just real quick, turn one page. We see the same chart for the members. It's a lot shorter chart because remember all those things that came from the unfunded page, they're not on here because the members don't pay for the unfunded. So all we have is the change in the assumptions, relatively modest. Now that's going to be different for safety versus general, but it's relatively modest here when aggregated. And there's the 47 basis points, and there is the shift in member demographics. Question.
I noticed you have a footnote at the bottom. These rates do not include employer subvention of member contributions or vice versa. Do you have a feel for just approximately how much or what groups we still have subvention? I know it's been phased out over a period of time. Is there any left?
Why don't you start and we'll let staff jump in.
At the moment, I don't have a feel other than yours that it has been phased out, but I'm not sure which ones are left.
Other people in the room may be able to answer that. Please do.
I think Contra Costa Fire still has a couple groups for subvention.
And Central San still has it, but that'll go away this April.
Good.
Fire subvention.
It's the reverse, reverse pickup, as we sometimes call it, right. Okay. Okay, let's go back to the front. And the last thing we're going to talk about a little bit is asset smoothing. We already touched on this when we looked at the two funded ratios. We'll just look at that under a couple other metrics. The bottom of triple I. Here we have in text what you saw in that picture, which is that the unrecognized loss is $175 million, whereas last year it was an unrecognized gain of $336. So the smooth value and the market value have crossed. Back in 2009, when we had over $1 billion of deferred losses, remember, the smooth value was $1 billion higher than the market value. Within Siegel, and although elsewhere, within Siegel, we determined that just telling people, okay, you got $1 billion of deferred losses and stopping didn't make that number concrete enough. So we came up with two ways of illustrating what does that mean in numbers that you're used to talking about. So what we show in these bullets is we start with the funded ratio. If you were to mark to market, if you were instead of using the smooth value, if you were to go to market value, which means you would lower the assets by $113 million, right? Which means you would lower increase your unfunded liability by $113 million if you went to market value. That would lower your funded ratio from 84.5 down to 82.4. Just to give you an idea of scale. And then we show what that was last year. Last year, because we were deferring gains, it went the other way. If you would mark to market, it would have increased your funded ratio. Now, that one, everybody talks about market value funded ratio, nobody gets upset. This one we got a little resistance on back in 2009. We actually show what the employer contribution rate would be if you were to use market value instead of the smooth value. And back in 2009, it took the contribution ratio from 20% up to 40%. It was a huge jump. And we were asked back then, when this number goes the other way, are you still going to publish it? And we said, yes, we did. And we have for the last 3 years. So we'll see that here. If you were to take that $113 million, put it into the unfunded by using market value instead of smooth value, amortize that $113 million over 18 years, right, because it's an investment loss, that would increase the employer rate by 1.8%, 39.2 up to 41 even. But notice that last year, if you do the same calculation, it would have taken it down from 40.1 down to 36.5. So really, these are just mirror images of how asset smoothing works. You're seeing it now, how it works after a down year. So then the last thing I want to look at is that asset smoothing stuff. We'll go in section 2 to page 5. I think it's 5. Page 5, for people who want to do this at home, this actually shows you how asset smoothing works. Unfortunately, because you have a 37-Act system, you have this interest crediting thing that you have to do, which happens on a six-month basis. So instead of, Jerry, in the slide that you remember from Pension 101, instead of seeing a nice 5 lines, you got 10 lines, because we actually do it every 6 months. And I wish we didn't, but, that's the way things are. So instead of the deferred factors being 80%, 20%, 60%, which would have a nice simple five-year smoothing. We actually do it in six-month periods. You can think of these as kind of lumped together, though, in pairs. And what this shows is that in the most recent year, it's really the most recent 6 months, you can see the investment gain loss in the second half of 2015 was a loss of $400 million. Okay, that's the negative return that we had for that particular year. We defer either 80 or 90% of that because of this every 6 month smoothing, which means you've got $380 million of losses in just the most recent year that we haven't recognized yet. Okay, but we are still also have some deferred gains from the earlier years. You net all those together, and we are deferring net losses of 175.
Right.
So that's the air in the ice cream this year. And now you're always allowed to ask, when is that going to show up in our costs? That is, when is that 100? We always say that if the fund earns exactly 7% going forward, then you are going to see over the next 4 years losses of exactly $175 million. But it's not going to hit on a level basis. Down at the bottom, we actually show it's actually going to be pretty flat for the first couple years, and then you will see the losses emerge in the last 3 years. Now, why is that? Well, it's because the next 3 years, you're recognizing each year one-fifth of the recent loss,
yeah,
but you're still recognizing the gains mm-hmm. that are somewhere between 3 and 5 years old. Mm-hmm. But after 3 years, all those gains will have been recognized, and you're still left with 2 to 3/5 of the most recent loss. So that's why you get this somewhat non-level pattern of recognition. And there's a technique. If this thing gets really unlevel, there's actually a technique called re-smoothing, which we've done with probably half of our cases. It's facts and circumstances based. It's not really called for here, but you just should know that that $175 million, even if you earn exactly 7%, it's not going to show up in four even pieces. It's going to be somewhat backloaded because the gains came before the losses. Right, so you're going to keep recognizing the gains for a couple years, then the losses after that. So I'm going to close with, let's skip, where do we have the table of the rates, John?
The earnings rates. The actual contribution rates?
No, the for now, the investment returns, yeah. Okay. Go to page 11.
We could be made.
11 and 12. Again, this is one more. This is the last thing we'll say about smoothing versus market. 11 shows the rates of return. I apologize we didn't mention these before because we've been saying all along that you had a good return on a smooth value and a bad return on a market value. Here you can see that. The market value return in the most recent year was about 1%, 0.95%. Now, the investment guys will come in and say, hey, at least we earned 1%. But what did the actuaries say? Okay, if you assumed 7.25, which you did last year, and you actually earned 1, that means actuarially you had a loss on market value of 6.25%. So you had a loss against the assumed return on market value, but on a smooth value, you earn 8.8 because you're still recognizing the gains from the previous years. And if you like pictures better, you can go to page 12. Page 12 shows this is not the dollar amount of the smooth return. This is the rates of return. But you get the same kind of picture. You can see you had almost minus 30% back in 2008. Everybody remember that? You had a market recovery in 8 and 9. The orange line there, the orange triangles, is the rates of return on a smooth basis. And just like we saw before, they follow the contours of the market returns, but they're just more smooth. Okay, that's our usual prepared stuff. I do want to show you, because we started talking about the normal cost rate and the unfunded payments and how those are split, I want to look at least at one page that will demonstrate that. So let's go to page 21, and then this will close our presentation. 21 is a good example. Now, chart 14 goes on for a while. You know, page 21 is cost groups, cost group one, which is really the big county tier, the old tiers. Page 22 has some more. The thing to notice on page 21, look in the very first column of numbers. And what you'll see here, let's see. Now, this is not a good example of that. Where's one where they're the same? No, turn to page 22, please. The normal costs are the same, and the unfundeds are equal. John, where do I find that?
You're not going to find that.
No, it's, okay. Well, let's do...
Because these are all just for POVs and stuff like that for each employer.
Yeah. Okay. You normally have a pattern where you'll have, I think we can find at least two of them. Let's go to page 23. I know it's in here somewhere. Okay. Page 23 will help. Now, what I'm trying to capture, look in the first column of numbers. You'll see that for County General Tier 4 and for County General Tier 3 with the courts, you notice those two, they have different normal costs because they have different benefit formulas. But they have the same unfunded liability payment. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, when we open up a new tier, you know, what we don't want to do is say, well, the unfunded liability is only going to be charged against the old tier, because as that old tier gets smaller and smaller, you have a closed group, and the unfunded liability payment as a rate is going to blow up just because the payroll is getting smaller and smaller. So what we do is we take the folks in the folks that are basically doing the same stuff, the folks in the legacy tier and the folks in a PEPRA tier, and we pool them for the unfunded payments. And that's what this is trying to demonstrate. So the unfunded liability for 2% COLA and for Tier 4 and Tier 3, they are pooled as far as the unfunded liability. That's why they have the same unfunded liability payment, but they have different normal costs because they have different benefit amounts. Maybe safety is a better example. We can do the same thing, for example, with here's a good one, page 26. This is probably the best one of all. Page 26, again, I'm looking just at basic. You've got three safety tiers here. You've got cost group 5, which is the CCA, the Fire Protection District Tier 1. You've got the same folks but in Tier 4. And you've got Tier 4 with a 3% COLA and a 2% COLA. Okay, so you have basically it's all the same workforce. It's just different tiers. They all have the same unfunded liability payment.
These are general, though.
Oh, it still says general. I'm sorry. Well, this still illustrates my point because this is at least the same. It's the same workforce. When we looked at the one before, it was actually different groups. So what this shows is the employer pays the same 10.3 toward the unfunded for all of these, but the reason that the folks in the 2% tier COLA are cheaper is because their normal cost is 9.54. Whereas up at the top, for a general tier one, it's 12.08. And so over time, as the legacy tier gets replaced by the new tiers, what you'll see is that normal cost will shift from the higher 12.08 into the lower normal cost below. That's really the only point I was trying to capture. The unfunded liability is the same for both the old and new tiers, and it's the change in normal cost that will gradually transition to lower costs. When we saw in the reconciliation of the cost rates, the change in demographics that led to a lower contribution rate for the employer, that was this shift of tiers. I just wanted to show the pooling of the unfunded, but the different normal cost that shows over a generation how the cost will shift. And I think you will see a similar page back for safety.
So I just want to clarify, I think what you're also saying here is that the new members to any of these cost groups that come in under PEPRA, from the employer standpoint, that total cost, which is normal plus unfunded, okay, that total cost for those new PEPRA employees is receiving an allocation of this legacy unfunded liability that those PEPRA members are getting assigned that cost throughout the future until that's paid off.
Well, but not the members, though. The employer is paying the same unfunded payment, whether it's an old person or a new person. That's okay. The idea.
Yeah. So that, you know, I have to wonder, you know, we do have this unfunded liability that is being assigned to those employees over the future. And that's that generational shift I think you referenced earlier of paying out into the future for this $1.3 billion that we're still sitting here with in unfunded liability. And I think that does affect out into the future. It affects those employees' abilities to get pay increases based on the total cost of compensation and benefits in the future.
Right. But that would be true whether you open a new tier or not. I mean, once you adopt an 18-year amortization period, okay, if someone is hired the next day, the employer is making a payment toward the unfunded based on that new hire's payroll. Right. That's true whether they're in the old tier or the new tier.
But the Pepper employees are getting a different benefit.
Well, but that's why they're all, but that, and because they're getting a different benefit, they are accruing a different normal cost. The normal cost is allocated based upon the benefit that's, it's not the value of the benefit earned, but it's based upon the benefit that the member is accruing. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, so the idea is when you're paying off the unfunded, that's a past cost. It doesn't matter what your current formula is because you're paying off the past. And so that's what this tries to capture. So, but it's important to know the fact that the new members are have an unfunded allocated to their payroll, that was true. That's true no matter which tier they're in. And just to repeat, the fact that they're in a lower benefit tier, that saves you money, but it only saves you benefit on the new year of service. Right. So I think this actually captures the intergenerational equity pretty well. It doesn't rejigger it. It doesn't say, well, just because the new members come into a new tier, therefore the current taxpayers should pay for all of the unfunded, and we should not be allocating that to these future payroll. Again, you were going to allocate unfunded payments to future hires anyway, and the fact that they're in a different tier doesn't change how you budget your unfunded payments. It only changes how you accrue new future costs, the normal costs.
Yeah, I think the unfunded liability, which I think you referenced in the beginning, was not maybe as important as some of us believe. It is important to the future employees who their employer is still having to pay off that cost from the past, and it's getting allocated to the total cost of that employee in the future.
Sure. But if I said anything that sounded like that the unfunded liability is not important, then I want to withdraw whatever that statement was. What I said was I don't like funded ratios as a metric. What I did say, the unfunded liability in dollars, let me be very clear. The unfunded liability in dollars is the most important number here. So if I said anything that made it think like I'm casual about the unfunded liability, I'm just saying that if you want to understand the unfunded, look at it in dollars, look at it as a percentage of payroll, look at the cost as a percentage of payroll, don't look at it as a percentage of assets. It's the funded ratio is the only thing that I was discounting. I in no way said that the unfunded liability is not important. In fact, just the opposite. That's mostly what we're talking about here. So.
Yeah, Deborah, many times that actually happens. So the employees will actually see that as well. They see that there's this huge cost that's put into the paid to the pension system by the employer on their paycheck, you know, essentially that's showing, but it's accounting for all that unfunded liability that they owe per the number of employees. It's allocated for the number of employees they have to divide it equally as a way to pay.
Right.
And to piggyback on that, well, then that number gets reported when, you know, the East Bay Times wants your thing with Transparent California. And so all this past accumulation on the for these Pepper people, it looks like they're getting this huge benefit. That's not really equitable in my opinion.
And I think to take that a step further, that's why it is important to continue the path that we've been on in the past, well, 4 or 5 years since I've been here, which is to continue to be conservative on you know the decreases in the assumed rate of return. I mean, we've got a report in front of us that says over the last 10 years, the historical return has been somewhere around 6%. So I think it's important for us to continue to be looking carefully at these assumptions and move them in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further questions or comments or reactions? Any from our audience? Are you done?
We are. Well, we got a GASB 68 report, unfortunately, but that's the next item.
Well, but in the interest of